What's up, y'all? Here's a quick recap of last week.
There's something happening with our kid, and we don't know what it is. My dad had a pretty deep depressive spell at one point whenever we were kids, and he and my mom just said, look, this might be, you know, the beginning of something.
Welcome back to part two. I'm so happy you're here. Let's dive in where we left off.
So I have two mental health disorders that I've lived with for a long time. And it changes, right? One is a mood disorder that we thought was bipolar type 2 for a while. But my last hospitalization, the psychiatric team said, really, you have major depressive disorder. And then they said this new thing I'd never heard before with anxious distress, right? So I have that one, and it's tied to my ADHD, severe ADHD. And so what major depressive disorder with anxious distress means is this. Whenever I get depressed, I don't typically just stay in bed for days. My brain that's already moving, trying to find dopamine everywhere because I don't have enough dopamine receptors, right? That's why I'm starting new projects and doing all this stuff, you know, and I can't follow through and there's going to be a cliff and I know I'm going to fall off of it. But if I just run a little bit faster, I can fly, right? You know, like all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Whenever my depression hits, it amplifies the chaos. Mm-hmm. And so everything becomes bigger than I can handle. And my brain is just going so fast and moving at such a clip that the only escape that I can see is to take my own life. And so most of my life I've been suicidal like that. And I have a beautiful wife, three incredible kids. I have a job that I love. I have three dogs that are like so much fun. I got a Martin guitar last year that I've been looking at and saving up for a long time. 1960, odd 18. I mean, it is like, it had been near a fire source. So it's all scarred and stuff. I've got a really great story about that guitar too, but, I have all of these things that should make me like an optimist, right?
Yeah.
And yet still I can't see a reason to live, right? So that tells me that it's not a moral failure on my part.
Right.
It's not a lack of joy. I'm not just looking at this shit, but like my brain legitimately as a part of my body is malfunctioning.
That's like
the church never told me that. The church always moralized it, even if they didn't think they were, right?
Yeah.
The peace that passes all understanding. Man, let me pray for you that God would speak to you in the midst of this difficulty, right? That something, that new life would grow from the manure that you're feeling right now or whatever. And as well-intentioned as it was, and as well-intentioned as it was when I did the same things to other people, it wasn't helpful because it was Jesus plus nothing, or you're a sinner and you're not putting your trust in Jesus. But now I know it's like Jesus plus Adderall, Jesus plus Effexor, Jesus plus Lamictal, Jesus plus, you know, the medications I take, Jesus plus therapy, Jesus plus constantly checking in with myself and my wife. And it doesn't mean that Jesus is diminished in that.
Yeah.
It magnifies the avenues through which I think God can speak to me, the Spirit can lead me, because I'm no longer like just beating myself over the head, which yeah. Let's face it, dude, if you're chronically depressed, like beating yourself up about it is probably not the most healthy or helpful.
Like, I mean, whether you're depressed or not, it's probably not, because it'll lead you into some kind of depressive state,
dude,
you know?
That's so true.
But that's, I wrote it down right now at 40 minute, because for the promo for this episode, I need to promo what you just said. Jesus plus this doesn't diminish Jesus. No. And I think it is a subversive teaching. Sometimes, not sometimes it's on the head. Sometimes the church is, it will make you feel like, oh, you're still broke after tithing. You don't have enough faith, or you're holding back something. There's always going to be some type of responsibility that they don't see that you're doing in the dark that is keeping you from your blessing. I always was one of those people that if something didn't go my way, I would immediately look, okay, where did I sin? What did I do that made me just miss out on this blessing? The closest thing to today that I would count that as is in our deconstructive process, and I've said this before to B and my friends, sometimes I wonder that because I'm not in the traditional mainstream space that is so safe that you're like laying on the lazy river of faith and all these people are pushing you towards the direction that everybody else is going. So you're not really working for the faith. You're just like arm in arm with the traditional mainstream faith that as long as we follow these rules, we're going in the right direction, bro. Yeah. Heaven is on that way. But then when you start deconstructing and start saying, I can't take this ride with you because I don't believe these certain things. Now you're the dude on the side not having fun and your inflated tube seems to keep losing air and you're like, damn, should I go back to this ideology? Should I go back? That's where I start feeling, oh no, am I in the wrong place? And I start feeling a little down about myself. But then I remember the freedom that I found on the other side of shame, on the other side of all the rules, on having to hold it all up. Like there's so, I've been saying this now more often than not, if religion becomes too difficult, then you're doing it wrong. And it's not even religion. I say religion.
No, I walked away from that word religion for a long time, but then I realized that it was tied to the same root as ligament. Mm. Something that allows movement and ties you to something. Right. And so I really have like reconciled with that word. Sorry to interject.
No. Yeah, but that's the case. You know, whatever set of beliefs that you have, if it becomes too difficult, then it becomes something that is definitely a man-made thing. Mm-hmm. Like you are now trusting in yourself to get you to the unknown, which is really what this faith thing is. There is an unknown in front of us, and we get mad that we can't figure this shit out. When it's like, bruh, if I were to ask you the square root of 144,000, you couldn't figure that out either. So it's like
712. No, I'm just kidding. I'm like not math person.
No, for real.
And also, by the way, I think we should shun Brandon because he's not rocking the red.
The red plan.
I'm wearing a maroon hat.
Okay, that count. We'll count.
It's my boy's mezcal company.
You're just not praying hard enough, man.
I'm not prayed up. Listen, I've just been busy.
No, I was gonna say something about that metaphor, Manny, about floating.
Mm-hmm. On the lazy river, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that for me, the waters just became so torrential internally. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I was experiencing spiritual vertigo, emotional vertigo. I didn't know. I have had moments in my life where I just couldn't catch my breath to even put any air into the floaty device, right? Mm,
yeah.
And it was in those moments that it was like, the tools that I had been given were no longer sufficient. Mm. The first time I was hospitalized was in April of 2021. We were in our small group. It was a Wednesday night. I think it was the 14th of April. So it's coming up on 2 years. And I had just reconciled myself to the fact that I was never going to be happy. Mm. I was like, it's just not in me. I want to be an artist. I can't be an artist. Everything in me says create, 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 but I've got to go and find money so that my family can live. It's just never, and I'm never going to be happy, right? And so we're Wednesday night, we're with our small group, and we have a therapist in our small group with us, and I'm like on the verge of tears, and I'm just like completely in despair, complete despair. And she says, I think you're sick. And then I'm like talking about all this stuff. And then my friend Jason, who's in there too, he says, you know, Tim, I'm not really sure that you're in the position to be making decisions for yourself right now. Because my friend Mark, he always says that depression is like wearing shit colored glasses. And when you're wearing those, you need somebody else to interpret reality for you. You need a translator. And so my group that night was a translator. So you need to get help. So I took the next day off of work. I went to my doctor with my wife and she said, you need residential treatment. Like you need to go to inpatient care. And I said, I'm a teacher in middle school. We have one act play coming up. I was teaching theater. I said, I've got to get my students ready for this. I have 8 more weeks of school. As soon as I'm done with school, I will go to inpatient treatment, inpatient care. And she looks at me and she says, I can remember it to this day. She looks at me, she says, Tim, I don't think you're going to make it.
Wow.
To summer. So the next day I check into treatment. I sleep for, I keep saying treatment, inpatient care at a psychiatric facility. Like I sleep. And the first night that I'm going to dinner with everybody else who's in the unit, you know, you've got me who's a novice and then you've got other folks who are veterans, right? Like they've been through it. They've been there a while. And now I'm a veteran. I've been hospitalized 5 times. I'm the OG now at this point, right? And we're walking to dinner and these I call them kids. They're like in their 20s or whatever, are inviting me to sit with them. And I have this chip on my shoulder. Like, I'm here for 12 days and then I'm out, you know? And I go through the line. I'm not sitting with them. I'm like, I just need some time alone. I sit down with my tray with my meat and gravy, whatever it is, like on my tray. And I had a fork because they don't have any knives, right? There's no plastic knives or anything like that. And so I'm like, how am I going to eat this thing? Do I just like stab it, you know, and like bring it up to my mouth, or do I perforate it, you know, like, and then break it in half or whatever? I can't figure it out, right? And this dude, I call him the fedora and the fur coat fedora kid, because that's how he came in psychosis, and he was wearing like a fur coat and a fedora. And so like he's looking at me across the cafeteria and I'm like, I'm so uncomfortable. But he looks at me, he goes, turn it around. And I'm like, like what? My tray? What? He says, turn it around. And I don't get what he's saying. He holds up his fork and he says, turn it. And the tines are up. And he puts it in his other hand and says, around. And I looked, and on the plates of all of the OGs, all of the people that had been through it, they had 2 forks. They had one fork that was a fork. And then the other fork, they used the handle as a knife.
Interesting.
Cut the meat. And in that moment, it was like a realization that the tools that you have, like, are no longer, they're no longer adequate for the challenges ahead. And so you need to re-envision what that tool looks like now. So prayer for me looks very different now than it did 10 years ago, even 2 years ago. Mm. Meditation for me looks very different now than it did a year ago, 2 years ago.
So what does it look like? I'm curious.
So prayer for me is
now,
a lot less talking and a lot more just breathing.
Okay. Yeah.
Prayer for me now is, considering like what's best for others and working to enact that. So like my children, what does it mean for me to want the best for them? And then to like put feet to my faith. And like, you know, to pray for their protection, to ask for their protection, but to also be their protector. Mm. Right. I've become the answer to my prayers a lot more. And community has become the answer to my prayer. You know, I would not have survived without people, human beings, frail, fragmented, beautiful human beings that have buoyed me to this life, right? Mm-hmm. And so for me, prayer is a lot more about looking out and seeing what's around me, and taking a big deep breath and saying like, this is enough. This moment right here is enough for me to stick around. Mm. Because even with all my medication, dude, there are times whenever I have intrusive thoughts, like so rapid fire, and I'm taking all my medications, dude. I'm trying to get in bed at the same time. I'm trying to eat healthy, you know. I've been on a bender with Pop-Tarts though for like the last I was doing no sugar, and then I got in the hospital again. Yo, dude, it messed me up, right? They got my meds figured out, but now I'm back on the sugars, all right? And, pray for me that I'd be delivered from from the demon.
The power of the Pop-Tarts.
The power of the Pop-Tarts be loose. What you say on earth and let it be in heaven, right? You know, like that.
Yo, I wanted to ask you, because you said earlier that your dad dealt with this as well. Is there anything in you that is like now super like looking at your kids like, yo, are they showing it? You know what I'm saying? Is anybody nervous? Is your wife like, can this, you know, because I don't really understand if it's something that can be passed. Is it a thing like that, or is it?
Well, my dad's depression is not as severe as mine.
Okay,
like he has clinical depression. He's dealt with it. He's taken medicine. That, like, kind of what I heard you and you, Brandon, talking about. There's circumstantial depression that makes sense, and then there's chemical.
Right.
Depression that you can look around and there's no rhyme or reason to it. You just can't see the light. And so my dad's journey has been different than mine. And I've even asked him if he's ever been suicidal. And he said there were times whenever he thought passively, you know, about maybe something would happen to him and he could kind of like break, you know, out of this world. But he was never really suicidal. Well, yeah, it's a huge fear, Manny. If I'm being honest, like, I'm afraid that this thing is going to catch up to me. Like, that this is going to be the thing that I know it's chronic, but I'm afraid it's going to become terminal. And if I lean too much into that fear, then I begin to think about my kids, like, did I pass this on to them? Well, if I pass this on to them, why, you know, it just takes me down like this really dark path.
Yeah.
You know, our kids are very open about mental illness and mental health. My wife and I, whenever I got hospitalized, the first thing we said was we are going to be honest about this journey and we're going to be open about it. We're going to take it public. We're going to talk about the beautiful things and the difficult things all together. And because we made that choice, our kids have a certain resiliency whenever it comes to talking about mental health. My son, my 8-year-old, has said, I need therapy. Why do you need therapy? Because I can't figure out why I'm feeling the way I'm feeling. That's profound self-realization.
Right.
Profound. We just talk about it. Now, does my 8-year-old know that I'm suicidal? No. Like, we don't burden them with...
Right.
Does my 15-year-old? Yeah, she knows. And she can tell before I can tell sometimes. You know, whenever I'm spiraling, my wife and my kids are they're like, oh, he's putting on the shit-colored glasses. We better get ready, you know? Mm-hmm. And they act as my translators and my interpreters. But yeah, it's a big fear that I have, dude. It's a big fear that I have that I've passed something on that, you know, because you don't want your kids to suffer. Even if I'm open to like a certain amount of suffering myself, like I understand that. You want them to be well. You want them to be okay, and you don't want them to have to. It's the reason why we're raising them different in the church too. You know.
Yeah.
Because we don't want them to like shoulder the burdens that we shouldered. Now, are they going to still need therapy when they grow up? Yeah, like we're trying to like screw them up as little as possible.
yeah.
Like we know, yeah, we tell them that. Look, we know that we're not perfect, but we're really trying hard to not screw you up.
Yeah.
And they're gracious, man. They I think their gift is grace and understanding too, you know. Yeah, it's yeah, I'm scared, dude. Yeah, I mean, I think you just tapped into something that I'm probably going to need to talk with my therapist about next week.
Well, because I don't know if it's something that can be passed, you know, because when you talk about clinical and it being an actual piece missing in the brain, I'm like, oh, man, that is definitely way more than how you view life. That's like,
it's genetic.
It's a genetic thing. Yeah, right. It's like what, you know, I'm curious as to whether or not you can pass that.
Well, scientifically, let's talk about science for a little bit. Yeah, there's genetic part of it. There's the way that your brain forms, not only from experiences you've had, but also from things that were happening in you in utero. Like, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of, my psychiatrist says it like this, the depression is a constellation of symptoms. Hmm. So the way that they figure out if you have, what kind of depression you have, how you have it, is they look at that constellation of symptoms, and they piece together the name for your specific brand of depression or anxiety or personality disorders or bipolar. So bipolar disorder is a mood disorder. Major depressive disorder is a mood disorder. My brain cannot regulate my mood because my neurotransmitters are off, right? Hmm. It doesn't mean that it's all physical, right? Because it manifests itself emotionally. The best way that I, and you know, I'm not a doctor either. Right. So if somebody jumps into the comments and is like, this dude knows nothing about this, well, there's my disclaimer. All right. I know I understand it from experience and from what I've tried to learn.
Yeah.
But please enlighten us to what it is. Unless you say it's Jesus plus nothing and you don't have enough proof. In which case I would challenge that theology. But the best illustration that I can find is that I have a friend who he's type 1 diabetic. And he has this little insulin pump. I don't know if you guys ever have any of your friends that have it. He has this little insulin pump, and I'll see him every once in a while. You'll hear this little beep, and he'll look down, and he'll realize that his blood sugar isn't where it needs to be. And so he'll push a little button, and it will, like, pump insulin into his body, and it will readjust his blood sugar levels, right? Mm. If he doesn't adjust those levels, then he can go into a coma. He can go into psychosis. He can wreck his car, and he can die. His body cannot regulate blood sugar, insulin levels, all that kind of stuff. And for me, my brain cannot regulate dopamine and serotonin and epinephrine and all of these things that come together to create a regulated mood.
Mm. Wow.
And so why do we moralize one and not the other?
Right.
If somebody's in a wheelchair and there's stairs in front of them, nobody, except for the most fundamentalist of fundamentalist people, would say, you know what? Get up and walk up the stairs, dude. Just get up and walk. Just try harder. But me, my whole fucking life, people have said, dude, you just got to try. Have you made a list, Tim? Have you made a list about all the things that you need to do and bills you need to pay? You know, yes, I've made lists. I don't know where they are, right? I got a Palm Pilot whenever I was a freshman in college, dude. A Palm Pilot, because I was like, this is it. This is going to keep me organized. I lost it after a week. No clue where it was, dude. So at Christmas time after my first semester, I'm driving with my friend, riding with my friend in the car, and I like drop my wallet or something. So I go to pick it up underneath the seat, and guess what I find? That freaking Palm Pilot, dude, is there. I took it out, I wrapped it up, and I gave it to my dad for Christmas that year, and he used it for like five years. I was like, yes, I've made lists. Yes, I've tried to look on the sunny side of life. But my brain, I don't have a pump. So the medicines that I take, the food that I eat, the sleep that I get is all contributing to that maintenance of my brain health. It, you know, just manifests itself emotionally. And so people get kind of freaked out about that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was a lot.
But what you just said was kind of like... I feel like anyone who is close to someone who lives with this in the same way, you know, you said something that kind of like hit me really, really hard, which makes me think of my brother, is I guess just the fear or the, which I don't want to speak this into existence, but the fear that you said of maybe running out of the steam, of running out of the, I'm going to look at this way, or I'm going to whatever like that. I feel like that's a very real fear for a lot of people that deal that live with this mental disorder, you know, like running out of that steam of that positivity or that,
yeah,
that effort to try the next thing, the next combination of things, the next Palm Pilot, you know, it's, yeah. And so, it, you know, the fact that you speak with the eloquence that you do and the charisma that you do, you know, it really, it's really like encouraging and a testament, like for real, for real.
It tethers me to life. Like, that's what I think a lot of people don't understand is that I'm not like, I don't want someone to ask me all the time whenever I'm out in the community, like, hey, how you doing, bud?
Right.
You know, how you doing? Because they saw my Facebook post or my Instagram story about me being in the hospital, but they do that. And I'm willing to like put, I'm willing to engage that because I know that the stigma on the other side costs lives.
Mm-hmm.
When the stigmas stay in place, people die.
Right.
Like, it's just the case. Like, people die. If we don't talk about it, if I don't share like what I've been through and what I'm going through, like as a family, like, it's not because I'm a savior. It's not because I feel like I can just like save everybody. But like, I know that like, if I don't talk about it, someone will get caught up in that. And you know who that someone is most of the time? It's me. I have to talk about it because it tethers me to this world and to these people and to this community. On the days whenever it's really, really hard there are some days that are just really, really hard, really, really difficult. And so if I dig into isolationism and hiding, the likelihood, we know this from the data, the likelihood of me completing suicide is higher. So I try to live in the open as a safeguard.
Sure.
For me. And you know, people don't always understand that. But it helps me. It's not selfish necessarily, I don't think, but where stigmas exist, like death is there.
Right.
Right along with it. Because it causes isolation and it causes you to like retreat into yourself. And then if you retreat into yourself so far, you know, you're never going to see that light, even though like, you know, we're created from light and created for light, right? Like, it's in there. My favorite passage of scripture that I hold on to, even after everything else that I've culled out and sifted through, is that Psalm 139 that, you know, if I make my bed in the pit of hell, even there your right hand will guide me, for the darkness is as light to you, right? And so John in his epistle is writing and he says that, don't you know that like perfect love dispels all fear? And so, and I'm not capable of perfect love, so if perfect love dispels all fear, if perfect love dispels all darkness, then my imperfect love will at least dispel a little bit. Right.
Yeah.
So, I just really try to cling to that light, even if it's like barely flickering there, because it can still, you know, we do no great things, only small things with great love. Like Mother Teresa says that, you know, and wow. I'm a firm believer in that. I just got into my feelings real big, y'all.
Oh, I love it, man. I love it. Cause that's like, you know, it's even there's even a passage in Psalm 18 and it talks about that he wraps himself in darkness that covered him like a tent. And it's the thought of the God of light, right? The light, the ultimate light wraps himself in darkness, that even in the darkness, there's light. Like, they look at it in a scientific level, down to the smallest thing. There's actually fractions of light within darkness, right?
Like, fascinating.
It's so interesting. So
it's fascinating.
Dude, it takes so much courage, man, to do what you're doing. And just even, I think there's so many things that, you know, someone listening to this could take away today from listening to you. So, dude, I just want to commend you for just being courageous on your journey. I know you're still on it. You're still in your process. And it's so encouraging to just see you be so open and honest as a tool that's ultimately for yourself and your own progress, but it's something, it's a tool that other people can like grab onto and can help them in their journey as well.
Yeah, right? I mean, like we link arms and leave creation in our wake, right? Like that's the vision. It's not linking arms and floating down the lazy river. It's like linking arms and leaving creation in our wake. And I'm just, I have all of these. And here's the thing too, man, I need to just have a conversation with y'all like off camera about how y'all do the work that you do. This is the thing that I'm called to right now. The vocation, Frederick Buechner said that like your vocation, your calling is where the world's deep hunger and your deep gladness meet, right? And so he also said that religion is, and sex are like dynamite. It can be used to heal the human heart or not what is this? Yeah, not dynamite. Damn, dude, I messed up his quote. It's like nitrous, like you, or something like you put in, it can be used to heal the human heart or blow up a bridge, right? And so he's just an incredible person. That's just a freebie. Read Frederick Buechner. But like for me, to be liberated myself and to liberate others to like live into the truth of who they are, even if they live with a mental health disorder, that's the calling. Classroom to the conference room, church pew to the bar stool, wherever it is, whoever you are, if this is a part of your story, like let's put on our grippy socks together and let's just leave creation in our wake, right? Yeah. You know, like that's the vision.
I freaking love it, dude. I absolutely do. I'm not gonna lie, like you're the type of cat, you know, if you lived in our city, we would kick it with you, bruh.
Bro, I just come to Nashville or LA and
bro, if you're ever holla.
We have been real and thinking about you in Nashville the last couple of days, dude. It's heartbreaking.
It is, man. It's you know, I was gonna talk to B about this, but I wanna do episodes where we do tackle current issues, and even though they're hot button, like a couple, you know, this gun thing, like we don't really get into politics.
I don't really speak about it from a political perspective. I'm an educator and I'm in all day every day. And
real quick though, I want to read this to you. I'm sorry. Keep your thought. Thank you. Karen says, thank you, Timothy, for sharing and discussing your past and present. One of my sisters has been depressed for years and it flows up and down. This gave me a lot of hope.
Wow, Karen, that's incredible. Thanks for sharing that. I really appreciate that.
But go ahead. As an educator, you said.
Yeah, it's a tragedy that we live with on the daily basis. You know, we can't keep our doors open in our school, even though it's liberating for ourselves and our students to have that free flow. We have to have them locked. And even that becomes a small T trauma, where we lose community and connection, right? And so for me, it's just so much bigger than any kind of soundbite. But if I were to, the distillation of it is that, you know, six people are dead.
Yeah. And it's 9 minutes from my house. You know, it's very.
9 minutes from you, dude?
Yeah, bro. It's super close.
Wow.
And, you know, some of the things that popped up that I was like, oh, these are going to be sound bites, you know? Like, I knew the second you found out what type of guns it was. I know initially when I found out it was a girl, but then I was like, that doesn't make sense because girls don't usually act out in this way. Even though I learned yesterday, my friend told me that the first mass shooter in America was a girl, which I got to look that up. So, but it's not typical for women to act out in this way. And then you find out I was a trans woman. And so now I'm like, oh, that's going to be the headline for the right. That would be another thing that they try to push. And not I'm more centered than anything, but I think the thing that hit me the most about it was we're so smart. We are so smart, you know, like we're figuring out ways to take normal people to the moon, but we can't figure this shit out. And well, I keep contending it has to happen to the right person. Like this negative thing has to happen to the right, powerful person in order to enact some kind of change. Because as long as it keeps happening to normal people, powerful people are just going to say what they always say.
One, isn't that what Jesus does? Like he challenges power, or what Paul called principalities, you know, and powers. And to me, for me, Isaiah 2, that, you know, that they will take their swords and beat them into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation will not rise up against nation anymore. For me to walk in the way of Jesus, for me, means a dedication to submitting like the tools of violence to the refining fire of God's love, and allowing God to shape those into instruments of cultivation and growth. And so for me, I'm like, okay, if I want to walk in the way of Jesus, and there's a lot of reasons why I've wanted to leave the church. Mm-hmm. A butt ton. All right. Just like how, as my kids say, a butt ton of reasons for me to like want to leave the church. But in that, I just find that it is, if I'm willing to dismantle and deconstruct whatever it is in me that's holding me away from this radical, inclusive gospel of Jesus, then there's a reason to stay, right? There's a reason to stay, and there's a reason to fight nonviolently, mm-hmm. like for people to see this liberating gospel. And when it comes to gun violence, I think we know the answer. We just don't. Like you said, man, what does it mean for me as a teacher in the classroom to challenge the powerful in an effort to save lives?
I think it becomes more of a, it's like what we do with Christianity, right? We have this insane problem with the LGBTQ community, and we do it with a violent righteousness, because that's what we call it. We call it righteousness. We're protecting Jesus and his religion.
Protecting our families.
We're protecting our family. Yeah. We're protecting Jesus. And I think, man, you're going so hard as if these people are taking your places in heaven. Like as if that if one of them gets in, one of you don't. So you got to defend this shit to the death. And yeah. I feel like we create extremes way more to hide the things that we really want. And extremists is like, yo, I understand. I'm a Second Amendment dude, like for real. But from my understanding was this was implemented so that government couldn't just run shot on you. Like if you had to defend yourself, the right to bear arms would be it if your government overreached.
Yeah.
So
we have, yeah.
I think like, and me and my boy had this conversation. He's like, yo, let them come try to, you know, like they were doing in Australia, like we're like, coming and getting you if you weren't vaxxed or if you weren't this, like, he's like, let somebody come. And I'm like, I get your point. But if our government, the most powerful and deadliest government on the face of the planet and in human history, no military has ever been this strong. If they want to come take us out, they gonna take us out. And your little AR-15s and your little fucking Call of Duty training, that shit ain't gonna do nothing. If they send Navy SEAL Team 6, they will wipe your ass out before you even know that you got to go get your gun. So it's like that argument is like,
yeah,
I mean, I want you to defend yourself, like for real. And I'm not even against an AR-15. I'm just saying like the reasons that we use of why we're going to fight for this thing is like the extremes. And I guess that's what these things are for. But I'm like, there has to be a middle ground. So I don't want to take your AR-15. I don't want to take your shit. I don't want to keep it. If that is your fear, because I also don't want to look at you and be like, oh, you shouldn't be fearful of that, because that's just them me projecting onto you. But I just think we are so smart. There has to be a way to just figure this out together to where both sides are like, I can rock with that. I'm good with that.
Yeah, dude. I was gonna say this. I remember a while back, Brian Zahn, who I've talked about several times on here. he had tweeted this thing, and I thought it was so clever, and it was so sad at the same time. And he said, "In gun we trust.
Mm.
Gun bless America.
Wow.
One nation under gun."
This is the idolatry of our day. It really is.
And you know, and it's funny because under that, obviously the comments were getting lit up, and it just makes you think. It's like the religious devotion that people have to guns among American evangelicals, at least,
for
is
sure.
Just is just flat out bizarre.
It doesn't make sense to me.
It's very strange. It's very strange to me. Like, it's like the devotion that you show here, like, I will flip it and turn into a preacher for in a second, is like, if you show this devotion to living out the Sermon on the Mount, you would have revival in your community.
Yeah. Like, that's really powerful, man.
If you went this hard in loving your neighbor.
Oh my gosh.
Like, you would see transformation. And again, it's the question, sometimes it becomes this shallow thing of like protection and all these like very much so logical answers. But the question is so much deeper than that, that Christ invites us into his way, right? And that is the nonviolent, that is the peaceable kingdom of God.
And what is
that
it? Or what Dr. King called the beloved community, right?
Yeah.
Like, he says, if you're going to call me extremist, that's fine. Call me an extremist for love. And Brandon, I think that it, and maybe in Manny, like, I think that for me, mental health and policy and religion, spirituality, Jesus kind of collide, is that I'm somebody who has an increased risk of dying by suicide. I want gun laws enacted that could prevent me from going to Walmart right now and having a firearm in my house.
Right.
I'm not talking about like anything other than me as a human being saying to the government and the regulators or whatever, I'm at a higher risk for dying by suicide. I want to put my name on a list so that anytime I try to go and buy a gun, I can get it. Now, can I get a gun if I want it? Yeah, I can go to a million different places and find a gun, but is it going to be harder for me? Is it going to give me 10 extra seconds or 10 extra minutes to really contemplate if this is the path that I want to go down to? Is it one more gate between me and ending my life by suicide? Like, yeah, it is. And so for me, like, gun control is a very real thing, because of a susceptibility that I have, a weakness that I have, or a reality in which I live. Guns are the leading cause of death for children in our country, and 95% of suicide attempts, something like that, 95% of suicide attempts, it might be less than that, y'all can check that, all right, but high 80 to 90 something percent of suicides that are completed are done with firearms. Taking pills, hanging yourself, all that stuff has a very low likelihood of being successful. That's why so many people that die by suicide use a firearm, because it's pretty much like 100% that's gonna happen. So I want gun legislation, not just for those kids at Covenant School, not just for the kids at Santa Fe, not just for the kids, you know, in Odessa, and like, I have a friend who was shot in Odessa during a mass shooting. Their little 2-year-old.
Wow.
Bullet went right through mouth. She survived, and I'm so grateful, but I want it for them, but I also want it for me. Like, we need to live in a place where it's safe for me, to, you know, if we want people to stop dying by suicide, which I want, I don't know anyone that'd be like, nah,
yeah,
just let them, you know, then we can make policies that allow people to have their freedoms, but also provide protection for the most vulnerable. I kind of look like a lumberjack right now. Like, I go out hunting right now, just like take this hat off and put on one of those like
hunting caps.
Yeah. I always, you know, I I hearken back to the Garden of Gethsemane and the one time that a violent act was happening. It's Jesus was the first one to be like, "Bro, you gotta put your sword away."
Yeah.
And I don't know a lot of people. This is the one thing, especially in America, that we'd overlook Jesus's way of handling of violence. We'll find every single justification to be like, nah, bruh. Like, we're going to have to go with the stars and stripes on this one. We're going to have to go with this damn, you know, this concoction that our forefathers did over Jesus's, like, let me heal this guy's ear and say, bruh, let it be. Like, we're good.
And honestly, like, I've been challenged by that text in my own journey, because, like, I'm really kind to other people. And I really want Jesus to heal their ears, but dude, I'll take that sword and start hacking away at my self-confidence, hacking away at like my own sense of like belovedness. And I feel like Jesus has said to me in my mental health struggle and in the way that I've walked and lived with mental health, like, dude, put down the sword. Put it down. You live by the sword, you're gonna die by the sword.
Yeah.
With every self-inflicted wound that I create. And I'm good at it. And Jesus is like, you know, so maybe that's where the transformation, the societal transformation happens, whenever we ourselves as followers of Jesus, like say, okay, I'm going to treat myself with that grace and that dignity that you talk about, that gift, right? Whenever I treat myself as the beloved child of God that I am, right? And from that transformation happens because I'm able to interact with other people. But that doesn't mean that I get to stop taking my medicine.
Right, right.
That doesn't mean that I get to stop going to therapy. What it does mean is that I can acknowledge, even in the deepest, darkest moments, and I can have someone reflect back to me that, you know what, like, when God created me, God said, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm not 100%, you know, firing on all cylinders.
Yeah.
Even though I might be a little throwed off, as my friends sometimes say, like, you know, to me, that's the transformation of my heart leads to the transformation of the world.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I love you guys. I genuinely like want to hang out. I want to fly to LA and then I want to fly to Nashville.
For real. No.
Dude, you could do a twofer. I mean, when Manny's back in LA, man,
yeah, I'll get back to here.
Yeah, we live like a little less than 14 minutes away from each other.
Yeah, I live. So I'm in LA and Nashville. So we're back and forth. So I'll leave this Friday back to LA, be there for like 2.5 weeks, and then come back to Nashville and then back to LA.
Do you like that?
I love it. I love it because I get to live in two worlds. Like, I'm in a very red state and then I live in a very blue state. And so it's very much one of those things where I'm like, oh, I get to see policies in real life. But our community is LA, because that's, you know, Brandon and our whole community is there. I have homies here, but we have community.
I know. Speaking of community, Ange is on her way over here. We're having dinner tonight.
Oh, good. Yeah. That's my wife. Ange is my wife. Yeah.
What are y'all going to eat?
My wife, Maddie, she's making
banging.
Pasta. I see some vodka out, so probably some vodka something pasta. It's bomb though.
That sounds really good, man. I haven't eaten tonight. It's my little son Quinn is playing baseball, so I'm about to get an update from them, and then I might just do like the whole pint of ice cream thing.
Yeah.
There's nobody else here, and so like, I don't have to share it with anyone. And then I'll throw it away and take the trash out to the dumpster, and like, no one will know. No one will know.
No.
I just said it on the internet.
No questions asked.
Yeah. Where did the ice cream go? Well, me. But I'm going to fly out to LA next week and hang out with my new friends, Manny and Brandon.
Bro, no cap, for real. Like, if you ever do end up flying to LA, like, holler at us. Because we'll.
Don't just see it, dude. I will show up. I will.
We'll kick it, bro. We'll kick it. There's no falsities.
What's the name of the dude that just shows up in Christmas Vacation? Uncle Eddie. I will Uncle Eddie. All right. I will knock on your door and I'll be like, where's the vodka and pasta? and just show myself in, dude. Christian community, man.
I love it, bro. Dude,
spicy vodka pasta, man. We'll got it. We'll save a bowl for you, bro. All
right, that sounds really good, man.
Bro, thanks so much for being here. Everybody who joined live, we're going again live tomorrow at 7:30 Central Standard Time. So if you guys want to be a part of the conversation again, come join us. We appreciate it, Timothy. We appreciate it. And like we always love to say, we pray you find a seat at the table. But if you don't, you are always welcome at ours. Cheers.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.